Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More now about the President and Congress. In a bit, we'll talk to John Stanton from Roll Call about where things stand after the State of the Union, specifically with regards to reconciliation, that process by which they could pass some of the health bill without a filibuster, and all those confusing procedural elements. But if you're a fan of transparency and dialogue rather than arcane procedure, you're probably a fan of what did take place on Friday. So here's another extended clip from that GOP conference. This one's almost 4 minutes, and it begins with Indiana Congressman Mike Pence. Then we'll hear President Obama's response.
Now, last year, about the time you met with us, unemployment was 7.5%. in this country. Your administration and your party in Congress told us that we'd have to borrow more than $700 billion to pay for a so-called stimulus bill that was a piecemeal list of projects and boutique tax cuts, all of which was, we were told, had to be passed or unemployment would go to 8%, as your administration said. Well, unemployment is 10% now, as you well know, Mr. President. Here in Baltimore, it's considerably higher. Now, Republicans offered a stimulus bill at the same time. It cost half as much as the Democrat proposal in Congress, and using your economic analyst models, it would have created twice the jobs at half the cost. It essentially was across-the-board tax relief, Mr. President. Now, we know you've come to Baltimore today, and you've raised this a tax credit which was last promoted by President Jimmy Carter. But the first question I would pose to you very respectfully, Mr. President, is would you be willing to consider embracing, in the name of little David Carter Jr. and his dad, in the name of every struggling family in this country, the kind of across-the-board tax relief that Republicans have advocated, that President Kennedy advocated, that President Reagan advocated, and that has always been the means of stimulating broad-based economic growth?
Well, there was a lot packed into that question there, Mike. I think we can score political points on the basis of the fact that we underestimated how severe the job losses were going to be. But those job losses took place before any stimulus, whether it was the ones that you guys have proposed or the ones that we proposed, could have ever taken to effect. Now, that's just the fact, Mike, and I don't think anybody would dispute that. You could not find an economist who would dispute that. Now, the package that we put together at the beginning of the year, the truth is, should have reflected, and I believe reflected, what most of you would say are common sense things. This notion that this was a radical package is just not true. A third of them were tax cuts, and they weren't, when you say they were boutique tax cuts, Mike, 95% of working Americans got tax cuts. Small businesses got tax cuts. Large businesses got help in terms of their depreciation schedules. And the notion that I would somehow resist doing something that cost half as much but would produce twice as many jobs, why would I resist that? I wouldn't. I mean, that's my point, is that I am not an ideologue. I'm not. It doesn't make sense if somebody could tell me you could do this cheaper and get increased results, that I wouldn't say, great. The problem is I couldn't find credible economists who would back up the claims that you just made.
President Obama responding to Indiana Representative Republican Mike Pence in that exchange that was right there for all to see on C-SPAN on Friday afternoon. So we played about a three-minute excerpt and about a four-minute excerpt. John Stanton, staff writer at Roll Call, joins us now. Hey, John, welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be here.
So 3 days after that, has anything changed? has it created a meaningful step toward a more business-like atmosphere between the president and congressional Republicans, or were they just both posturing for their own gain?
I think there was a little bit of posturing going on. I do think that the president being sort of so forthcoming with Republicans, particularly out in public like that, will help, at least in the short term, the relationships between Republicans and Democrats. I think it sets a tone for Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and some Democratic leaders that, at least in sort of the near term, they need to try to find some kind of middle ground with Republicans. And for Republicans, I think it now puts, to a certain degree, a little bit of the onus on them to start trying to work with Democrats. They've done a sort of an excellent job over the last year of painting the president and congressional Democrats as being partisan and not trying to work with them. And I think this sort of counteracted that to a certain degree. So it could, at least in the next few months, do some good.
And one of the reasons that we invited you on today was to explain to our listeners the ways in which the Democratic Congress might still pass the health care bill, even without Republican cooperation, if they dare to try to do it that way. Because on Friday, Speaker Pelosi said, "We believe that it's possible to have comprehensive health care reform as we go forward, but at the same time, it can be on another track where some things can just be passed outside of that legislation, and we'll be doing both." So my question for you, John, is she talking in code there about the process known as reconciliation, which is a way to get around the Senate filibuster?
That's what she was referring to, yes. And the way that would work is they would take not all of the health care bill, but a pretty good portion of it, put it into the budget reconciliation package, and then the House would pass it, and they would send it to the Senate. The overall bill is not a filibusterable bill. It's the only sort of mechanism for not having a 60-vote threshold, which makes it much easier for Majority Leader Reid, obviously, to get the votes that he would need to pass the bill.
You mean the overall budget bill, the federal budget, is not a filibusterable bill, correct?
Exactly. Under the Senate rules, you only need 50 votes to pass it. However, there are a series of what they're called budget points of order, which are debatable and which Republicans could filibuster on within that sort of framework. So they could at the very least stretch it out for days or for weeks if they really wanted to. But the broader question, I think, is whether or not Senator Reid can even get the 50 votes that he would need, since Vice President Biden could come in and sort of cast the tie vote if he could only get 50 Democrats to vote for it. It's unclear whether or not he can actually do that at this point.
So. You think after Massachusetts, too many Democrats might be afraid?
Exactly. And also, but even before Scott Brown's election, there were a number of moderate Democrats who openly expressed skepticism about using this process. It's always sort of a divisive way to go about business. And if they were to do it sort of in the short term here, it would definitely destroy any possibility of any sort of bipartisanship on pretty much anything for the rest of the year. So it's a delicate game for the Democrats at this point.
So you see it as unlikely. But if they were to do it, what would that mean about the content of the bill? Because if it's supposed to be a reconciliation of budget measures, does that mean that some of the features of the bill that aren't specifically budget items could not be included, including some of the most popular features like barring insurance companies from denying coverage based on pre-existing conditions? Because that's not a budget item. That would be a matter of regulating an industry, right?
That's a big part of it. There are some mechanisms they can use under the budget reconciliation because they sort of included language referring to these things already within the bill that they could sort of rope it in. But then those would become subject to budget points of order. And it's not clear whether Majority Leader Reid would actually have the 60 votes to overcome those challenges. They'd have to keep those to a bare minimum. And so a lot of the regulatory pieces would have to be carved out and put into a separate bill. And the concern, I think, over in the Senate particularly, is that if they do use budget reconciliation to pass a portion of it, that second bill may never be able to get even to the floor, or if it does, to get out of the Senate because of sort of the poisoned atmosphere reconciliation could cause.
John Stanton from Roll Call with us on WNYC. And after the election of Scott Brown, and the loss of that vaunted 60th vote. We've had a number of folks in our audience saying, who cares about the 60th vote? Call their bluff and make the Republicans filibuster, which is in a way what President Obama started to do on Friday, obviously not in a legislative process in this retreat. But he was calling their bluff. He was getting up there before the cameras and everybody and saying, look, you're wrong. In fact, you're purposely twisting things that are in this health care bill. And on some of the points where we disagree, you're wrong on policy. And here's why I think so. And making them squirm and defend their talking points. The Senate majority could kind of take the same tack in, you know, in the legislative process and make those 41 senators stand up there and actually defend to the country hour after hour, day after day, maybe week after week, because that's what a filibuster could turn into, while they block this health reform bill.
Well, there's some talk of that. In fact, particularly amongst progressives in the Senate and outside of the Senate, there is this push to as you say, call their bluff. It becomes a difficult thing for Senator Reid, though. He really wants to show that they have done something. It's a much more difficult game for them politically to make the case that Republicans are blocking things they believe than it is to show that they've done something. And so there's this feeling that they want to try to pass some things while still trying to show that Republicans are blockading these. And I think he and his sort of top lieutenants are still trying to figure out sort of the calculus of that, how they get around them on a couple of things while still sort of hammering Republicans for being obstructionists.
I asked this of Andrew Sullivan earlier in the hour, but yesterday Matt Bai wrote in the New York Times Magazine that losing the huge majority in the Senate and House this fall wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for this president and for the Democratic Party, that LBJ accomplished the vast majority of his sweeping legislation with a narrow margin in Congress, that he was able to use influence in ways that President Obama maybe hasn't yet, that the Clinton presidency was revitalized by the 1994 loss of his Democratic majorities in Congress. How much do you buy that?
I actually would agree with him to a certain degree. It's an interesting thing that happens here, that when the party that holds the presidency, if they have too large of a majority, the sort of divisions between two parties drop off, and what it becomes then is a division within their own party that becomes increasingly more difficult to deal with, particularly in a period like this where they had a rapid escalation into the majority and then into a supermajority, where you have a lot of members that are on the fence or they are in unsafe districts in the House or unsafe Senate seats. You know, there is a lot of pressure for them to buck the president. And inter-party divisions are always much more difficult for a president to overcome, whereas when they have tighter majorities or if they're working with one or more of the houses being in the opposite party, it opens up this sort of area for dialogue with the other side, with the moderates in the other party, and puts some pressure on the president's own wing to sort of capitulate on some issues and sort of agree to some changes to reforms or proposals that they would not necessarily agree to if the president has the kind of majority he has right now. So,
but if you look at the so-called Clinton revival, as Bai calls it, after 1994, they mostly accomplished Republican agenda items like ending welfare and balancing the budget. The Democratic agenda items that the president accomplished, President Clinton at that point, were very small. On the other hand, Bush and his Congress, when he had a Republican Congress in the first few years of his term, got their big conservative things done from 2001 to 2004. Tax cuts for the wealthy, war in Iraq, packing the court, further deregulating the banks, thanks a lot. So it can be done. It seems like it's easier for Republicans to do it than Democrats to do. We have 30 seconds left. What do you think?
Well, Republicans do have an amount of discipline and sort of party loyalty that Democrats have just never been able to demonstrate, frankly. I do think President Bush, though, was helped by September 11th. You know, it really made it so that for about a year and a half, 2 years, almost no one questioned what he was doing, and it opened up the door for a lot of other things. But there's no question that Democrats always have had a problem, sort of sticking together and sort of being single-minded in what they want to do, whereas Republicans have always been able to do that.
John Stanton, staff writer for Roll Call, thanks for coming on with us today.
Thank you.
And listeners, again, you can see the entire exchange between President Obama and the congressional Republicans on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You can also post your reactions and join in the conversation there about what the president and that conversation hath wrought, if anything. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.